I gave you a portion of our divinity, a spark from our own fire, the power to act and not to act, the will to get and the will to avoid. If you pay heed to this, you will not groan. You will blame no man. You will flatter none. And then Epictetus said, We must die. But must we die groaning? We must be imprisoned. We must be imprisoned, he said. But must we whine as well? What say you, fellow? Chain me? My leg you will chain. Yes, but my will. No, not even Zeus can conquer that. You say, I will imprison you. I say, my bit of a body, you mean? You say, I will behead you. I say, when did I ever tell you that I was the only man in the world that could not be beheaded? It is circumstances which show what men are. Therefore, when a difficulty falls upon you, remember that Zeus, like a trainer of wrestlers, has matched you with a rough young man. For what purpose, you may say? Why, that you may become an Olympic conqueror. But it is not accomplished without sweat.
Yo, Conrad!
It was Five-O, who was sitting on the edge of the bunk below.
One other thing, Mobra, okay? The new fish, they think so if...
And Five-O was off on another lesson for the first-timer, on the ways of jailhouse life. Conrad didn't want another lesson just now. He had a sudden, overwhelming thirst for the words of this man he had never heard of before, this man whose name he couldn't even begin to pronounce, Epictetus. At the same time, he didn't want to risk losing the newly acquired goodwill of his celly, as the prisoners called their cellmates, and so he figured he had better pay attention.
"The new fish," Five-O was saying, "they think so if they stay real quiet kind. If they no make ass, if they act like they just coasting kine, if they bother no more nobody, then they going stay invisible. Cannot, brah. You either this thing or you one other thing. You no stay invisible. You either one player or one punk, yeah? And these buggers..."
He raised his hand high enough for Conrad to see it, and made a circle in the air, as if to take in the entire pod.
"If they think you one punk, then you real had it. Bombay, they goin' grind you."
Conrad didn't want to start a conversation. He wanted to get back to Epictetus. But the word grind got him. It frightened him. "Hi, Conrad. How you doing, bro?" In Pidgin, as he knew by now, grind meant eat, bite, chew up, swallow, obliterate. "But how do you get to be a player?" he asked Five-O. "What can you do?"
"No do, no more nothing, brah. Use the mouth. No make beef with the buggers. Use the mouth."
Conrad pondered this advice, but couldn't imagine what it actually meant. The white singers and the clarinets and the trombones were now bobbing along in some rickety old song about jiggers of moonlight. The pod was going scrack, 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 scrack,
thragoom, glug, 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 motherfucker, motherfucker, motherfucker.
And then you could hear the aluminum clatter of the meal trolley beginning to roll through the pod.
"Yo, trustee! Trustee!"
Inmates elevated to the status of trustee, thanks to good behavior. At Santa Rita, the word was always pronounced trustee. Dispense the meals off the trolleys on thin paper plates with the cheapest plastic utensils imaginable. If you liked pancakes for breakfast and roast chicken for dinner, you wouldn't starve at Santa Rita. The lunch, which was always a sandwich of processed meat, shot through with what looked like blood vessels and tendons, was inedible, as were the powdered eggs at breakfast, which tasted oddly like prunes. But you could get by on the pancakes and the chicken.
You, trustee!
The meal trolley rattled closer. Five-O picked up the ice cream cup with the sandwich wrap stretched across the top and went to the door, stuck the cup out the slot, then cocked his head and squinted out at the cup. Then he pulled the cup back in and turned to Conrad and said,
"Hey, try look."
So Conrad walked over to the door and did as Five-O had done. He stuck the cup out through the slot and squinted at it. The cup's top cap was the one Five-O had blackened with a ballpoint pen. The top, which he had forced down into the cup, plus the stretch wrap, which he had pulled tight over the opening, created a mirror, a rear-view mirror, as it were. He could look down the line of cells. He could see the meal trolley, a tall aluminum cart full of shelves, two cells away. He could see the stacks of paper plates with roast chicken legs on them. Croker Global. 80 pounds. Croker Global supplied Santa Rita. He had just finished humping a Santa Rita order the night he was laid off. The cartons of frozen chicken legs weighed 80 pounds apiece. For an instant he was back inside the icy cliffs of the suicidal freezer unit, struggling with those frozen, dun-colored cubes. Maybe Kenny or Lightbulb or Herbie had humped the very carton these chicken legs came from. And he was now on the receiving end in this unbelievable place. The trustee pushing the meal trolley was a tall but terribly thin and gawky Chinese, wearing a pair of big round black-rimmed glasses. He was probably in his late 20s. He looked like an ancient Mandarin scholar in embryo. Conrad pulled the cup and his arm back inside the cell, and Five-O, standing right beside him, lifted a forefinger straight up, at eye level, as if to say, "Hark!" and said,
"Try listen, Conrad. Use the mouth."
He winked. Soon there was a rap on the cell door, and you could see the big black-rimmed eyeglasses of the Chinese trustee at the slot. In a reedy voice he said,
"Yo, mealtime."
Five-O walked to the slot, squared his jaws, and stared at the trustee with a steady, deep, malevolent gaze. The trustee passed a paper plate with a chicken leg on it through the slot. Five-O took it, turned back toward Conrad, winked again, picked up the chicken leg, took a huge bite, and put the remains back on the plate. Almost half the meat was gone. Then he turned back to the trustee and pushed the plate and the chewed chicken leg back through the slot, and, his cheeks still crammed with food, managed to say,
"Hey, bummers, man, try look. Some bugger went grind half the motherfucking chicken. You go and give me one not a plate, man."
He beamed such a malevolent look at the gawky Chinese that if looks could kill, the man would have died on the spot. But he didn't take the plate back. He just stared at Five-O and said,
"Say what?"
"Spock, check out. The motherfucking chicken, brother. Some bugger went grind half the motherfucker. You go and give me one other one."
"Ah, come on, man," said the trustee wearily. "You ate half that leg of chicken yon self." Conrad saw a glimmer of dismay in Five-O's eyes. The trustee's voice had deepened, and he didn't sound like some weak, skinny Chinese. If anything, he sounded black. Five-O narrowed his eyes and clenched his jaws and tried a growl.
"Huh? What? Like beef?"
Five-O's face was so furious, you didn't have to know Pigeon to know that he was saying, "You want to fight?" The skinny Chinese with the big spectacles said,
"Look, brother, I'm a number in here, and you a number in here, see? And I ain't trying to disrespect you. I'm just trying to do my time. You understand what I'm saying? I ain't trying to sweat you, and I ain't trying to play you. So what you dogging me for? I ain't rolling his motherfucking trolley through here to come sweat you, play you, dog you, get over on you, run a game on you, or any other damn thing, see?
By now Conrad was as perplexed as 5-0. Pouring out of the larynx of this slight, bespectacled, scholarly-looking Chinese was the voice of an East Oakland homeboy, a righteous one, with heart, a blood among bloods who knew how to get down and tend to business.
So, brother, you can have half of this pod and half of Santa Rita and half of Alameda County and half of the whole damn East Bay for all I care. But don't be dogging me about no half a damn leg of chicken, 'cause ain't a damn thing in the world I can do with the other half of it except and get myself all fucked up with my shot collar. My shot collar, he say, you let yourself get dogged, brother, you gon' get yourself double-dogged. By me, see?
So why don't you kindly do the right thing, brother, and take this here paper plate and that half a damn leg of chicken and go with God, shake 'em or lake 'em. And you and me's 50-50, and everything's cool.
His jaw slack, his mouth half open, 5-0 pulled the plate back through the slot without a word, in slow motion, all the while staring at this skinny Chinese with the bleary glasses and the baggy yellow felony pajamas. The light went out in 5-0's eyes. He moved slowly away from the door, holding the plate at chest level, looking toward the bunk, as if in a trance. Conrad stepped up to the door and took the second plate, which the trustee now put through the slot. 5-0 was sitting on the edge of his bunk, staring at the wall. You could hear the trolley rattling as the trustee pushed it to the next cell. Conrad didn't know whether to look at 5-0 or not. The man had just been humiliated. After all his big talk, he was the one who had backed down. But 5-0 himself solved that one for him.
"No laugh, you!"
He stared at Conrad angrily, but then his expression changed from angry to doleful.
"Hey, bummers, man, yeah? Hear that bugger? Well, that bugger get connections. That bugger get connections with the Popolos from long time. No bulai.
No bullshit, brah.
Maybe the Black Gorilla family, eh? Maybe the Crips. No can afford 'em make beef with them buggers."
He shook his head disconsolately. What ran through Conrad's mind was, do I dare say the obvious? The tactful thing would be to say nothing and perhaps just nod to note the sagacity of this latest advice. But something told him this might in fact be a moment when he could forge a bond with his celly. So he dared. "That trustee's not a big guy like you, 5-0. He's just a skinny, weak-looking guy with thick glasses." Irritably.
"And then?"
"And then so maybe he took your advice."
"Yeah? That's what?"
"Remember what you just told me?" said Conrad.
"You said use the mouth.
You said, don't get into a beef, use the mouth." "Well, that trustee can really use the mouth.
That bugger can talk, 5-0.
Sitting there, holding his plate in his lap, 5-0 narrowed his eyes and scowled. Then his face relaxed, and he looked straight ahead at the wall, as if deep in thought. Then he turned back toward Conrad, and a smile stole over his face. He started nodding.
"For real, brah," he said softly. "For real."
He chortled ruefully.
"That bugger when used a mouth. That bugger's mouth mo' big than mine's. That China boy, he stay one motor mouth, to the max."
He started laughing.
"No more mind me, Conrad. Try listen that China bugger."
Every afternoon at 1 and every evening at 6, the deputies turned the inmates out of their cells and led them into the pod room for 4 hours of communal pod time, as it was known. Strictly speaking, you didn't have to leave your cell. But if you didn't, you were locked in, and that was that. You couldn't go back and forth from the cell to the pod room. Conrad was so afraid of having to deal with Rotto, he was sorely tempted to stay inside. But on the other hand, staying inside that 5x9 lizard cage all day long, looking up through the screen at the catwalk, listening to the attic fans struggling, was a grim prospect. And sooner or later you had to come out to take a shower. And he didn't want his now friendly Sally to think he was eccentric, or worse, frightened. And his body ached for the chance to move around, if only in that grim, gray pod room. And something within him, his useless, deluded soul, told him he must not surrender to fear. So he trooped on out with 5-0 and the others. The pod room was a large rectangle of concrete with two rows of metal tables and metal stools out in the middle. The tables and the stools, like every other piece of furniture in the pod, were bolted to the floor. Along one side of the room were the open showers with the concrete retaining wall in front of them. And along the opposite side, also separated from the rest of the space by a retaining wall, was a line of open toilets and basins. Down at one end were two public telephones that could be used for outgoing collect calls only. Not too far away was a television set up on a metal stanchion. To change the channels, you had to be somebody tall standing on one of the metal tables. Overhead, there was no wire screen and no catwalk. The main instrument of surveillance was a video camera high up in one corner that fed a screen the deputies monitored. From the position of the camera, you could tell that things could go on in the shower area without the deputies ever knowing. Of this, at the moment, Conrad was dreadfully aware. His job was to stay as far away from Rotto and his boys as possible without getting anywhere near Vastly and his boys. Every time he so much as glanced toward the telephones and the television set, he could pick out Vastly immediately. The yellow ribbons on his cornrows created a strange floating field of gold above his head. Right now he was seated, along with a half-dozen of his followers, at the table that offered the best view of the television screen. They had found a channel showing a concert, in some huge arena, featuring a black singer named Lorelei Washburn. Lorelei Washburn was a screamer. Given a choice between a high register and a low one, she always went high and screamed in order to reach the note, tearing out the heart of me. Her screams ricocheted off the gray concrete of the pod room. But Vastly and the boys had no interest in Lorelei Washburn, who was wearing a white dress that was sleek, silky, and tight-fitting, but also long and not particularly revealing. No, their entire attention seemed to be pinned on her backup singers, three tan-skinned girls wearing pleated miniskirts that barely covered their bottoms. When they swiveled their hips or whirled, and they swiveled and whirled constantly, the pleated skirts rose up like pinwheels, revealing tiny, glittery bikini panties. Little more than cash sexes, these panties were, and the sight of so much nearly bare booty drove Vastly's gang wild.
"That's a real deal, baby! Right on, bro! No more that homosexual faggot drag queen B-cat turned out punk shit!"
"Yeah, it's a real shit. It's live, man, it ain't Memorex. I'm full of juke, sugar. Look at the booty on that mama. Shake your booty. Juke your booty."
Conrad's blood ran cold. Turned out punk. The message he heard in these shouts had nothing to do with the three sexy young performers on the screen. These men, the rulers of the pod at Santa Rita, preferred women, but they regarded homosexuals as a perfectly acceptable substitute while you were in jail. And in jail, in addition to the drag queens and the B-cats, who might be found anywhere, there were also the turned-out punks, young and slightly built new fish, like the Mutt Sims of long ago, who were forced to commit or submit to homosexual acts. Conrad now surveyed the pod room with a horrible clarity. It was a foul gray chamber inhabited by grim organisms in yellow felony pajamas who arranged themselves in primitive territorial packs. The prime territory was the end of the room where the two telephones and the television set were located, and the blacks had all of that to themselves. Most of the black inmates kept their heads shaved, or close to it, but some of them wore their hair long and wrapped do-rags around their heads. All the do-rags were green, because the only way they could get the material was to rip it off the green sheets the jail issued. It infuriated the deputies, all these insults to county property, but the practice never died. The most sinister-looking do-rag wearer, as Conrad saw it, was sitting next to Vastly at this moment. A tall, gaunt young man with sunken cheeks and a degenerate slouch, known as Rapmaster M.C. New York. He wrapped his do-rag down so low it almost covered his eyes. He looked like a black pirate. A few, most notably Vastly, wore their hair in cornrows or dreadlocks. Bunched together the way they were, they looked supremely powerful. And in the pod room, in fact, they were. The possibility that some white or Latin inmate just ambling over and using a telephone or changing the television channel without Vastly's permission was nil. The Latinos mainly hung around one side of the room over by the open toilets and the basins. Most of them were Mexican. They kept their hair short and liked to wear necklaces with crosses, which they wove out of plastic lace left over from packaged items from the commissary. They seemed to spend half the pod time shadowboxing. Lefts, rights, hooks, combinations. Their brown fists were tearing the air to pieces. What good that would do anybody in a jailhouse fight, Conrad couldn't imagine. You only had to look across the way to where the black inmates had commandeered the entryway to the showers to do their dips, to buff up, to keep accumulating the brute power that ruled the pod. The Latinos gave each other mildly deprecatory nicknames, such as Flaco, Skinny, Gordo, Fat Man, Wedo, Blondie, Oso, Grizzly Bear, and, curiously, Wino. Wino was the Nuestra Familia shot caller. He was a short, heavy-set, sleepy-looking man, probably in his early 30s, not very prepossessing. And yet everyone, even Vastly and company, seemed to give him plenty of room. The white inmates, who congregated up here, far away from the telephones, gave each other nicknames that were straight-out demeaning. Rotto, Mutt, Riffraff, Slimy, Sleazeman. And, like Mutt, took offense if any outsider presumed to call them that. The inner core, members of the Nordic Bund, were heavily tattooed and wore their hair in ponytails, or else combed it back on the sides and let it run down the backs of their necks in wild mongrel tangles. Like Maury, the giant from the tow truck company. His huge figure rose up once more in Conrad's mind. There were only four Asians in the pod, 5-0 and three young Chinese drug dealers from Oakland. Like 5-0, they stuck close to the Latinos during pod time. Packs. Dens. Utterly primitive animal turfs. Conrad sat down by himself at a table. He had brought along a writing tablet and a Bic ballpoint pen, and his book, The Stoics. He set about writing a letter to Jill and Carl and Christy. Right away he realized it was really the children he wanted to reach. He was so afraid they would forget him altogether. He tried to draw a picture of an elephant, with a comic strip balloon over its head saying, "Hi, Carl. Hi, Christy." But he wasn't much of an artist, and he couldn't figure out where the elephant's mouth went, or which way the hind legs were supposed to bend.
Well, at least it was something that might make them think of their father. As for Jill, he realized he didn't know what to say to her. Should he pour his heart out? Something told him that would be a tactical mistake. A tactical mistake. What a sad thing it was to have to think tactically about your own wife. Every minute or so he lifted his eyes and cut a glance toward the end of the room, where Rotto held court. He could feel his heart strumming along far too fast. If anything happened, he would have no allies, and he couldn't imagine where he would ever find any. His new pal in the house, 5-0, had scarcely looked at him once they reached the pod room, let alone talk to him. Obviously, he didn't want to be seen hanging out with some new white fish. Conrad wasn't even surprised. That was 5-0. 5-0 spent the pod time with his Latino buddies, although Conrad now saw him chatting with a couple of the hard-looking Okies. Evidently, he was giving them the details of Mutt's set-to with the deputies. He made a little kick in the air, and then lunged forward a step with his forearm raised, pantomiming Mutt's surprise assault on Armantrout. Conrad couldn't hear what he was saying, but no doubt he was assuring them he had been Mutt's staunch ally, shoulder to shoulder, shank to flank, until the bitter end. He studied the Okies for a moment. They were white, but there was no way he could approach them. The Nordic Bund. They were all bigger and tougher versions of Mutt. Except for the color of their skin, they were as alien as the black gorilla family. The only other whites were hopeless cases who could offer no protection at all. There was a pudgy man in his mid-40s, if Conrad had to guess, with thinning light brown hair, who was referred to only as Pops or Old Man.
"Yo, Pops! Hey, Old Man!"
But that apparently was true of all inmates who were over 40. Unless they were brutes with fearsome reputations, they lost not only their real names, but also their nicknames. They were written off. They were history. They became just Pops or Old Man. This particular Pops walked around the pod room with his puffy eyes half closed and his feet dragging across the floor, in a pathetic gait known as the Siniquan Shuffle. Siniquan was a drug, like Thorazine, which was used to tranquilize J-cats. This Pops was pathetic, and he did the shuffle, but he wasn't so crazy. He kept shuffling around throughout the entire pod time, never standing still, apparently not looking at a thing. But he never shuffled near the Latinos, much less the blacks. He wasn't J-cat enough to do some stupid J-cat thing like let himself stray from the white turf. Then there was Pocahontas. Pocahontas was a new fish, newer than Conrad. Tall, 6'3 or 6'4, skinny, practically anorexic, pale, close to being albino, young. As young as Conrad. He had a mohawk haircut, no eyebrows, and four tiny sinkholes in the rim of his left ear, where there had no doubt been a row of earrings prior to his arrival at Santa Rita. The mohawk was a narrow brush of auburn hair bisecting his shaved head. He had shaved off his eyebrows, too, while he was at it. His movements, the way he walked, the way he carried things, were effeminate. He had immediately picked up the nickname Pocahontas. The fact that the real Pocahontas was a Powhatan princess, rather than a Mohawk, was a historical nicety not likely to trouble anybody in D-Pod, West Greystone, Santa Rita Rehabilitation Center. The boy sat with a shell back and a collapsed posture at one of the tables, his pale green eyes blank, looking utterly miserable. Conrad not only felt sorry for him, but also felt an obligation to try to help him in some way. But what could he possibly do? And then he felt guilty.
since he also knew he didn't want to be lumped with him as a pal and fellow B-cat. On the screen atop the metal pole, Lorelei Washburn continued to wail and fill the pod with her screams. "At the heartless feet of you!" And her three backup singers continued to swivel and whirl and shake their nearly bare booties. And Vastly and the boys offered up more prayers to their god, sexual conquest.
"Ooh, baby, I've been down in Santa Rita too long. This is the lick. This is the real lick for a change, bro. No more B-cat booty, man. Give me the booty all rooty. I'm gonna mack a sweet meat crack. No more juking punks. I want some booty in my bunk."
To Conrad's great relief, the pod time ground by without Rotto even seeming to notice his existence, much less making a move in his direction. By the end, shortly before 10 p.m., he had managed to complete his letter and his clumsy, labored drawing, and to read 3 chapters of the extant writings of Epictetus. The words of this one-time prison inmate from 2,000 years ago resonated across the millennia with an electrifying clarity. It seemed that, in fact, these were not Epictetus' writings, but his dialogues, his colloquies with his disciples, as recorded by one of them, whose name was Arian. Thanks to the conversational tone, there was an immediacy about everything he said. Conrad had a picture of a crippled old man with wisps of gray hair on his head, but a full beard. According to the introduction, all the Roman philosophers wore beards. An old man wearing a beard and a toga, sitting on a chair in a bare room with a small group of young men, also wearing togas, sitting at his feet. And now they are joined by a young man wearing yellow felony pajamas and flip-flop sandals and a mustache, who takes a seat on the floor, at the rear of the group, ever so quietly and reverently. In Book 1, Chapter 2, the group gets into a discussion of what a man should do when faced with the choice of either submitting to something degrading or else suffering severe punishment or death. Epictetus says, "To the rational creature, only the irrational is unbearable. The rational he can always bear. Blows are not by nature intolerable." One of his disciples, no doubt a young man about Conrad's own age in a toga, says, "What do you mean?" Epictetus proceeds to tell how Florus, a Roman historian, was summoned by Nero to act in one of his notorious spectacles. Nero delighted in forcing famous and noble Romans to put on costumes and go on stage and act out degrading roles in so-called tragedies he devised. To refuse was to risk death. Badly shaken, Florus goes to see his friend Agrippinus, the Stoic philosopher. "What should I do," says Florus, "if I refuse, I will be beheaded. If I take part, I will be humiliated before all of Rome." "Nero has summoned me too," says Agrippinus. "So what do we do?" says Florus. "You appear in the tragedy," says Agrippinus. "And you?" "I will not," says the Stoic. "But why should I and not you appear in this spectacle?" says Florus. "Because you have considered it," says the Stoic. Then Epictetus tells them about an Olympic athlete who was threatened with death if he did not allow himself to be castrated so that he might serve as a statuesque eunuch, a human ornament in Nero's seraglio. His brother, who was a philosopher, came to him and said, "Brother, what will you do? Are we to let the knife do its work?" The athlete refused and was executed. "How did he die?" asks one of the disciples. "As an athlete or as a philosopher?"
He died as a man, says Epictetus, and a man who had wrestled at Olympia and been proclaimed victor. One who had passed his days in anointing himself with oil, so that all can admire him. Another man would have consented to have even his head cut off, if he could have lived without it. That is what I mean about keeping your character. Such is its power with those who have acquired the habit of carrying it into every question that arises. You can be the ordinary thread in the tunic, or you can be the purple, that touch of brilliance that gives distinction to the rest. His final example is from his own life. It seemed that the Emperor Domitian, Nero's successor, had ordered all the philosophers of Rome to go into exile. But if they shaved off their beards, that is, symbolize for all to see that they were no longer philosophers but ordinary men bowing before the emperor, they could remain in Rome and live in peace. Epictetus refused. They said, "We must behead you, then." "So be it," I said. "Behead me, if it is better for you that way. When did I tell you that I was immortal? You will do your part, and I mine. It is yours to kill, mine to die without quailing. Yours to banish, mine to go into exile without groaning." He was sent into exile. One of the disciples says, "How then shall we discover each of us what suits his character?" Epictetus says, "How does the bull, when the lion attacks, discover what powers he is endowed with? It is plain that each of us who has power of this sort will not be unaware of its possession. Like the bull, the man of noble nature does not become noble all of a sudden. He must train through the winter and make ready, and not lightly leap to meet things that concern him not." Conrad looked up from the pages before him on the metal table. He was aware of all the yellow felony pajamas, eddying and fidgeting about in clumps in their various turfs. The pudgy white man, Pops, still had his head down and his eyes nearly shut, doing his sine qua non shuffle not far from Rotto and a clutch of his tattooed Okies, who were huddled with downcast, shit-kickin' looks on their faces. Pocahontas was sitting collapsed over a metal table with his head, his ludicrous auburn mohawk and all, resting on his forearms, which seemed terribly thin, pale, and spidery. The Mexicans were still pulverizing their phantom enemies with their hooks, jabs, and straight rights in the air, while Five-O joked about with the one with the light hair, Wedo. One of Vastly's boys, a short, very dark man, with prodigious shoulders, neck, and chest, was over by the showers doing his dips in the opening of the retaining wall, while two more waited their turn. And Vastly himself still held court with most of his retinue at the table in front of the television set. The tiny yellow paper ribbons seemed to fairly gleam above his cornrow hairdo. He and his boys were watching a television show called Posse, about a black gang in Los Angeles, full of gunfire, maudlin laments about the hood, and dialogue that struck Conrad as totally unrealistic, since on television nobody said motherfuckin'. "That's the law of the hood, man," said a character on the screen, a young man who rocked along in a Frankenstein gait, wearing a pair of bulky black sneakers, voluminous, homey jeans whose crotch came down to his knees, a black leather jacket with numerous lethal-looking zippers, a do-rag, and an expression of terminal anger. "And ain't no police you can run to take care of the law of the hood." Vastly nodded, and his boys nodded with him. They were engrossed. This was drama. This was the real lick, no doubt. What would Epictetus have done with this bunch? What could he have done? How could you apply his lessons 2,000 years later in this grimy gray pod, this pigsty full of beasts who grunted about motherfucking this and motherfucking that, and turning boys into B-cats and jukin' punks. And yet, were they really any worse than Nero and his imperial guard? Epictetus spoke to him, from half a world and 2,000 years away. The answer was somewhere in these pages. What little bit Conrad had learned about philosophy at Mount Diablo had seemed to concern people who were free and whose main problem was to choose from among life's infinite possibilities. Only Epictetus began with the assumption that life is hard, brutal, punishing, narrow, and confining, a deadly business, and that fairness and unfairness are beside the point. Only Epictetus, so far as Conrad knew, was a philosopher who had been stripped of everything, imprisoned, tortured, enslaved, threatened with death. And only Epictetus had looked his tormentors in the eye and said, "You do what you have to do, and I will do what I have to do, which is live and die like a man." And he had prevailed. But most important of all, only Epictetus understood. He understood. Only he understood why Conrad Hensley had refused to accept a plea bargain. Only Epictetus understood why he had refused to lower himself just a rung or two, demean himself just a little bit, dishonor himself just a touch, confess to a minor crime, a mere misdemeanor, in order to avoid the risk of a jail sentence. Each of us considers what is in keeping with his character. His lawyer, even his own wife, wanted him to compromise and plead falsely. But he knew himself, and at how much he put his worth. He did not count himself as an ordinary thread in the tunic, but as the purple, that touch of brilliance that gives distinction to the rest. When the deputies announced the end of pod time, Conrad gathered up the folios of the Stoics, his letter, his writing tablet, his ballpoint pen, and walked to the cell with his shoulders back and his head high. Lights out was at 10 p.m. There was no announcement. The lights hanging from the underside of the catwalk went off, and so did the music being broadcast over the PA system. The deputies had lights somewhere up on the catwalk, however, so the pod was never pitch black. 5-0 was lying on the bottom bunk, and Conrad was stretched out on the top bunk, beneath the lizard wire. As usual, it was too hot. He could hear the deputies moving around on the catwalk. The place must have been even hotter for them, since they were up near the ceiling. "Scrack, scrack, scrack!" The attic fans were still screeching. "Thragoom, thragoom!" The toilets were still flushing. Glug, 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 glug. Conrad's thoughts kept racing and tumbling in the semi-darkness. His last glimpse of Jill, Carl and Christy. Would he ever see them again? Rotto, the Nero of the pod, and the inevitable showdown. Or did it have to be? Epictetus, his only hope. He longed for light, so that he could get back into the poor bedraggled pages of that book, which he kept up here on the bunk next to the wall. Now he could see Epictetus' beard, his old thin body, his toga. What would Epictetus have had to say about Jill and Carl and Christy? And once more his thoughts spun around. He couldn't begin to relax enough to sleep. But in fact, there was no sleep for anyone in the pod. Every night, at lights out, a session began in the darkness, a therapy session, a jam session, a hoedown, a prayer meeting, a Pentecostal confessional, a tribal rumble, a shriek into the void, a wailing for that which never was and that which never would be, a lamentation concerning fate. Conrad didn't know what to call it, but every night it took place in the darkness, over the wire. Someone began moaning, "Meds,
Meds. 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 Meds.
Medicines were distributed each day to those on the meds list by a nurse named Maggie, who was referred to, sometimes to her face, as Maggot.
Meds! Meds! Meds!
The moans stretched out longer and longer. From somewhere, "Shut the fuck up, you jakehead motherfucker!"
Meds! Meds! Meds!
From somewhere else,
"Pill call, Maggot!"
Cries began to rain down over the wire from all over the pod.
"Where you at, Maggot? Get on in here and give the motherfucker his sine qua non."
A new voice.
"Fuck the meds. I want a Rolly. I want some Bugler."
The voice that had been moaning for the meds said,
"You know Hank Aaron, the first Negro slave baseball player that owned a yellow wool suit?"
"Motherfuck, I gotta listen that shit all night. That motherfucker's gone J-Cat again. Where's that Maggot at?"
"Voice on the TV," said the J-Cat. "Told me I'm gonna die if I go outside. I don't wanna die!"
It was a real shriek.
"You gonna die for damn sure you don't shut the fuck up."
"I want a Rolly. I want some Bugler, goddammit. Yo, Sheriff, where the Bugler at?"
A black voice imitating an Okie deputy.
"New procedure. Gon' stick your right leg out your porthole so's I can see you. Then you get your Bugler."
"I want a light."
"How about a Bud Light?"
"You, brothers, you!"
Conrad's heart jumped. It was a big voice. Such a big voice that he thought it must be Vasily's, even though he didn't really know what Vasily's voice was like.
"Just come over the wire. That gray motherfucker had burnt the cross in Hayward."
In O-Town Street parlance, gray meant white.
"They got that motherfucker over in B-Pod."
There had been an incident, mentioned on television, in which someone had burned a cross on the lawn of a black family. B-Pod was the isolation pod, where prisoners were removed from the general population and kept one to a cell.
"The fuck? He's ass out, that motherfucker! Ass out! Ass out! Ass out! Ass out!"
The cry swept the pod.
"Never mind them Peckerwoods. Got a ex-police right here in D-14.
A huge voice.
"Who the fuck are you, motherfucker, talking about ex-police? The fuck, you saying you got some paperwork on me? Man, you out of pocket." "I'm saying, you motherfucker, you're the one that's trying to put jackets on everybody."
A jacket was a file prison authorities kept on informants.
"You're trying to fire everybody's ass up. You're the one that's under, motherfucker."
Short for working undercover.
"You're the one that's the snitch." Fuck your You keep on trying to hang jackets on people, you're going to get your cap peeled."
The huge voice had won the debate, and a chorus of imprecations against the accuser rolled through the pod.
"Motherfucker's running a game, messing with the unity. He the snake his own self."
"Meds! Meds! Meds!"
"Yo! One of y'all, kite me a Rolly."
To kite something was to send it from one cell to another, hand by hand, through the openings in the wire cages overhead.
"Yo, Dinky Man, where you at, baby brother?"
"K-Isle, man, K-Isle. Call my woman and tell her to take that 6 G's to my mama's house and get the deed to her house and take it to my bondsman. My mama's got another 4,500 of my money. Tell her I'm going to beat her ass if she don't do it."
"Man, she say she don't have no 6 G's of yo's."
"What? Just tell the bitch to do what I said."
"Okay, man. Thank you, baby brother. Shit, I got 200 G's. The fuck do I want to stay in jail for?"
"Woo-wee! Super fly!"
"Yo, deputy, there's a spider in my house. I don't play that shit. You gotta do something. Call the exterminator."
The voice of Anoki from up on the catwalk.
"Why don't you both go to sleep? Spider say he's ass out, too."
Yo, Heavy, read me that kite again from that African bitch over in East Greystone. Need some music to jack off by.
Dark in here, man. How you expect me to read that kite?
Then remember it, Heavy. Part about getting licked 10 times a day.
Masturbation was so prevalent at Santa Rita, after lights out, you could actually hear the joints and flat springs of the metal bunks groaning and squeaking. Conrad could hear them now. He could hear undisguised groans.
Oh!
He could hear exclamations of satisfaction.
God damn! Good jukin'!
And now, amid the whiffs of body funk, urine, bowel movements, and bugler smoke, there arose, as it did every night, the sickly, sweet smell of semen. Geysers of it. Gallons of it. Juke, 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 juke. There had been nights when Mutt and Five-O had both been going at it at the same time, Five-O on the upper bunk and Mutt down below, barely a yard from where Conrad lay jackknifed on the mattress on the floor. In these lizard cages of despair and terror, he couldn't imagine unlocking his nervous system's defenses long enough even to fantasize about sexual joy. But few others seemed to have any such constraint. They were lying back on their bunks, slogging away. They were transported. Testosterone. Brute sexual energy. A herd of young male animals. He had the impression that if some night they managed to masturbate in a harmonic wave, Santa Rita would rise right up out of the ground and flip over. And then the tucka-tucka-tucka-tucka-tucka-tucka began. It was the sound of scores of tiny makeshift bongo drums starting to beat. Every night the inmates, including many of the white ones, took plastic spoons and began rapping on the bottoms of empty ice cream cups. This was the invitation for the great entertainer, the Wraith with the do-rag, rapmaster M.C. New York, to begin his act. In the light, in the pod room, he looked like someone wasted and ravaged beyond all hope. But at night, in the dark, he seemed as big as all of Santa Rita. His voice filled the old barracks. The ice-cream cup percussion swelled in volume, and a voice sang out,
"And now, direct from the Apollo Theater in New York City!"
This was Dinky Man, the Rapmaster's herald and backup singer.
"Rapmaster M.C. New York!"
A burst of cheers, and then the pod grew quiet. All you could hear at first was the thrum of an electric bass, which an inmate called Beatbox was able to create, a cappella, deep in his throat, as the O-Town boys waited for the opening line they loved. And here it came. The big baritone voice of the Rapmaster chanted,
"Yo, sugar, think that's a ruby you got stuck inside your crack?"
A collective moan of approval swept through the pod.
"The fuck your booty turned to gold while you was lying on your back?"
The chorus began to keep time by slapping their hands on the bunk frames as well as wrapping the cups.
"Ain't trying no more sweet talk, baby. Hubba ho, no street talk, maybe. So you don't get a homie's dick, 'cause this homie's got a dicky itch, and I ain't gonna play it shit, so give it up, bitch."
By the time he reached the it and give it up, bitch, the pod was screaming the refrain over the wire, for this was the Rapmaster's theme song. In an instant the pod was resounding with the hymn to its one god, raw masculinity.
"Give it up, bitch! Give it up, bitch! Give it up, bitch! Give it up, bitch!"
Lying there on the top bunk, as the sound rolled over him, Conrad felt his hands grow cold and his torso grow terribly hot, and he broke out into a sweat. He had been hearing "Give it up, bitch" every night for 10 days, but now its meaning truly sank in. At Santa Rita, "Give it up, bitch" was the cry of absolute male conquest. Whatever you have, your body, your booty, your ass, your money, your honor, your self-respect, your good name, it's now mine, and you'll either give it to me or I'll rip it out of you. And when would Conrad Hensley's moment come? The percussion of the ice cream cups and the slaps on the bunk frames continued, but the voices grew silent as the homies, the O-Town homeboys, waited for the rapmaster's second stanza. The second stanza was always something new. You could hear Beatbox making his electric bass sounds deep in his throat, and then the rapmaster resumed.
Shorty's Johnson, he go roamin'. Homie jeans are his packin' heat. Inside that cracker hack's own home, and bottom lady wants that sweet dark meat.
Hideous laughter. The O-Town homies picked up every reference right away. Shorty was code for the sort of man who goes around making love to other men's bottom ladies when the men are out of the house. Shorty's Johnson was his penis, which was hot as a pistol. Packin' heat. A cracker hack was an Okie deputy.
No more tiny cracker dickies, lordy. Gimme your big Jimbo shorty. Fo' at cracker come back, cause I can't take that tiny gray hack's mackin'.
Howls, cries, ululations. The boys were beside themselves. Mackin was love-making. This was a ballad of the O-Town boys subjecting the Okie deputies, who were up on the catwalk at this very moment, to the ultimate ignominy, cuckolding them in their own homes.
"At gray hose dyin' for shorties, pitch, so!"
This time the chorus didn't even wait for the rapmaster. With a contemptuous laughing roar they broke into the refrain. The very air of the pod exploded with,
"Give it up, bitch! Give it up, bitch! Give it up, bitch! Give it up, bitch!"
Most of the code the deputies couldn't figure out. But hack was an old and familiar slang term for jailhouse guards, and cracker was the standard O-Town derogation for white people. And so, at the very least, the deputies knew that this particular stanza of Rapmaster M.C. New York's composition was about them. As soon as the ruckus died down a bit, one of them yelled from the catwalk,
"Yo! Knock off that damn jungle music!"
Laughter, whistles, catcalls, and then the voice of the Rapmaster himself.
"What's the problem, man? We just having a little unity down here."
The deputy yelled,
"Steppin' on your fucking knuckles and hollering is what you doing."
More laughter, ruder catcalls. They were so wound up they didn't even take offense. The rapmaster had just put this bunch of lame-brain crackers in their place, but good. On the top bunk, Conrad propped himself on one elbow. He looked up through the screen, past the silhouette of the catwalk, until he could make out a corner of one of the clerestory windows. He stared, 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 hoping for some glimpse of the outside world. A star, a fragment of the moon. But there was nothing. His world was now this lizard cage in this pod, which was gorged with anger and testosterone. Everything boiled down to the power of the brute, which was constantly expressed in terms of sexual conquest. He lay down flat on his back and closed his eyes and listened to the testicular squall as it raged over the wire. Sooner or later, his time would come. Of that he had no doubt. And what character would he bring to the encounter? How would he act? How does the bull, when the lion attacks, discover what powers he is endowed with? It is plain that each of us who has the power will not be unaware of its possessions. Like the bull, the man of noble nature does not become noble all of a sudden. He must train through the winter and make ready. He tried to review his own life. He had refused to accept a plea bargain. His spirit sank all over again. No matter what he had done, how could it help him? He was young, white, and slightly built, and he had no comrades, and he was penned up with the brutes in Pod D, West Greystone, Santa Rita. Lying there in the dark, he ran his right hand down his left arm, from the shoulder to the hand, and then he ran his left hand down his right arm. He still had his big forearms and wrists and hands, the only legacy of 6 months as a beast of burden in the suicidal freezer unit at Croker Global. But what earthly good would these poor arms be against Rotto and his boys? He was barely half the size of any of them. "I gave you a portion of our divinity," said Zeus, "a spark from our own fire." His eyes tightly shut, Conrad sought to shut out everything, all sounds and all other evidence of his senses, so as to feel the spark of Zeus and open himself to his divine energy. Where it would come from and what it might feel like, he had no idea. All he knew was that it was time to beckon it and surrender himself to it. Zeus. Zeus. How would he even know it when it came? Having never believed in a god and having never prayed before, he didn't even know that this was prayer. Chapter 18. The Aha Phenomenon. It had just turned dark, and Atlanta's pride and joy in the arts, the High Museum, was ablaze with the light that poured from its windows up on the eminence of a knoll at Peachtree and 16th Streets, right across from the First Presbyterian Church. The museum was fiercely different from the church. The church, built in 1919, was a stately, dark, and stony neo-Gothic pile. The museum, built in 1983, was pure white and modern in the Corbusier mode. It stretched on for half the length of a football field in a parade of white geometric shapes, from cubes to cylinders and everything in between and back again, all of it adorned with white pipe railings. La Tou Atlanta was there, for this was the opening of the notorious but glorious Wilson Lapith exhibition. A storm of voices, a regular typhoon, raged in the museum's grand atrium, until the very air seemed to exert an unbearable pressure. It made Martha Croker dizzy. So many tuxedos and extravagant dresses, so many grinning white faces, so many boiling teeth, so many cackling laughs, so many white ramps and railings, so many throats screaming at the euphoria of knowing they had arrived in the one place in all Atlanta where anyone of any social wattage whatsoever was supposed to be on this particular evening in May. Oh, destiny! Martha turned toward her escort, a tall, plump, pleasant, 50-ish man named Herbert Longleaf, whom Joyce had found for her, and he smiled and leaned toward her, and said something that was immediately swept away by the deafening screams and cackles of the tuxedos and fancy dresses. Joyce's boyfriend, Glenn Branwaste, a handsome but gloomy-looking 42-year-old, rolled his eyes as if to say, "Useless to even try to talk." Joyce's little face was resolutely radiant with makeup and her party smile. She looked at Martha and swung her big brown mascaraed eyes upward as if to say, "Isn't this something?" The atrium was an immense space, almost 50 feet high and pure white, like the building's exterior. Up a great curved window wall with white industrial muntins rose a series of curving ramps, one above the other, with white pipe railings and white wire grills instead of balusters. Spotlights and floodlights beamed down from all over the place in a factory work bay galaxy. On a balcony, an exhibition wall bore two immense Wilson Lapith paintings, the same two Martha had seen in Atlanta magazine. The size was startling. The figures seemed twice as big as life. There was the chain gang, and the two handsome young prisoners, clad in prison stripes, reaching out toward one another with looks of abject romantic yearning on their fair young faces. And there was the prison dormitory, and all the fair young flesh, prisoners half-clad, prisoners practically naked, prisoners without a stitch on. The painting throbbed with pent-up sexuality. The boys seemed to be about 3 seconds from plunging into a homosexual rout. And this, a gay delirium, was the aegis underneath which Le Tou Atlanta had assembled in this place. Martha looked about her, half expecting to see hundreds of amazed faces turned up toward the vast tableau on the balcony. But not at all. They were like the crowd at any other Atlanta gala. They had eyes only for one another. The way they grinned and screamed and cackled, it could just as easily have been the juvenile diabetes ball or a Georgia Tech alumni banquet. Perhaps by now everybody, even in Atlanta, just accepted the notion that art was supposed to be perverse, troublesome, and, what was the word, confrontational. Perhaps they had all glanced at those two paintings and decided that if the late Mr. Lapith's libidinal kinks hadn't been any more outrageous than this, then Atlanta could take it. The happy, bawling mob was packed in all around Herbert, Joyce, Glenn, and Martha. But somehow a young man wearing a tuxedo and a mint-green bow tie appeared with a tray full of flutes of champagne. And they each took one. The mint-green bow tie was the familiar insignia of the caterer, Colonel Popover. And for an instant Martha flashed back to all the parties and ribbon-cuttings Crooker Global had staged with Colonel Popover, an enormously fat man, whatever his real name was, as the caterer. But she hadn't come here to think about Charlie. Quite the opposite. A new destiny. She took a sip of the champagne. Not bad. She smiled at Joyce and Herbert and Glenn. Smiles all around. Another sip of champagne. And another. The crowd surged and heaved and roared. Before she knew it, a very tall man was standing barely an arm's length away, talking to someone she couldn't see. His back was almost completely to her, but she had no trouble recognizing him. He was so hunched over that his neck jutted forward, and his nose looked like a pointer's. Arthur Lomprey, it had to be, the president of Planner's Bank. She had sat next to him at dinner on at least 3 different occasions back when Charlie was trying to get the financing for Croker Concourse. There was something patronizing about the way Arthur Lomprey always cocked his canted over head and squinted and smiled as he talked, as if he were letting you in on secrets from on high that you probably couldn't comprehend anyway. But she did know him, and something was gnawing at her. The urge to show that she was part of the social swim. After all, this was her return to society. She had paid $20,000 for a table and invited 9 guests. She had bought this dress. A black silk taffeta embroidered with tiny red dots, bare-shouldered and scarcely even knee-length. She was proud of her wide shoulders and well-turned calves. For $3,500. She had anointed her shoulders with baby oil to make them glisten. She had spent $4,200 for this necklace, watch-chain gold with small rubies, $225 for hair coloring, pineapple blonde, and a hairdo at Philippe Brudnoy's, $150 for makeup at La Crosse, $850 for these black lizard and patent leather high-heeled shoes, plus she couldn't remember how much on Mustafa Gunt's class at Definition America, in hopes of giving herself a body more like a boy with breasts. On top of that, she had just downed a glass of champagne. So she inched closer to the tall, stooped figure and exclaimed, "Arthur!" Arthur Lomprey turned and looked at her, and his smile spread so far she could have counted his teeth. But his eyes were pure panic. They contracted into little frozen balls. "Mayday," they said. "Code Blue, I've met this woman somewhere before, but who in the name of God is she?"
"Hey!" he exclaimed. "How you doing?"
All the while grinning foolishly, as his eyes began a frantic search for a clue. They bounced all over her hairdo, her tinctured locks, her made-up face, the necklace, the dress, the glistening shoulders, and whatever else he could see of her rigorously exercised body.
"How are the children?"
he exclaimed finally, taking a desperate chance. "How are the children?" This was the deepest wound of all. The man had just scanned the best she could possibly present to the world after spending $8,925 plus untold hours of cardiovascular agony at the hands of a Turkish martinet. And that fully analog, non-digital, chemically activated computer, his brain, had arrived in milliseconds at the answer. Matronly. So, how are the children? Martha wanted to scream, but in her stunned condition, the best she could do was say lamely and mechanically, "Fine."
"That's terrific,"
exclaimed Arthur Lamprey, who probably hadn't even heard her.
"That's terrific."
He kept bobbing his head to show just how terrific it was, and looking straight through her, trying to devise some way to remove himself from her presence before he was compelled to introduce her to the people he was with. Who was this superfluous woman? Who was this invisible ex-wife? Who was this social ghost, without a husband at her side to give her an identity? She didn't wait for the situation to become any more painful. She pivoted and turned back to Joyce, Joyce's Glenn, and Herbert Longleaf. At last, in that roaring sea, Peepgas spotted another of those lads with the mint-green bow ties and the trays of champagne. This one looked like a blonde prep school boy on the precipice of his first plunge into debauchery. But that was merely a mental blip, the fleetest of passing thoughts. The main thing was to get to him and lay hands on another glass of champagne. All the grinning faces shrieked to be heard. The noise choked the air. The crowd was packed so close together in this part of the atrium, he would have to wriggle like a fish to get through. The path to the champagne lay between a man and a woman who had their backs to each other. The woman had on a black dress with an extravagant flounce of material, a gigantic bow, just below the waist, surmounting her buttocks. The man was a real porker with a bottom so big it forced apart the vent in the back of his dinner jacket. Peepgas took a deep breath. He tried to flatten himself. He made his move, turned sideways, tried to slip through. He got stuck. Both of them, the man and the woman, turned their heads and glowered at him. "Excuse me," he exclaimed. "I'm very sorry." A smile of social shame slithered across his face. But with a supreme, ungainly, much-resented effort, he forced his way through. Thank God the boy with the mint-green bow tie hadn't been able to budge. Peepgas took a glass of champagne from the tray. A quick look about. He was hemmed in on all sides by people he didn't know. A quick look above. On the balcony, Wilson Lapith's pale and handsome young prisoners, Trey Gay, reigned over Atlanta's big money. All very odd. He lifted the champagne to his lips and took a sip. He loved it. He was torn between the desire to dawdle over the glass, so as to have something to do, some bit of party business to perform, even if it was only to drink a glass of champagne, so that he wouldn't appear to be an utter social cipher, and an urge to knock back another glass of champagne. The animal urge overcame the social insecurity. He downed the champagne in four rapid gulps, put the empty flute back on the tray, and grabbed another one. The boy with the bow tie gave him a startled, reproving look. Peepgas offered a smile of apology. A delicious warmth rose from his stomach and filled his head like a cloud. He had an overwhelming urge to find somebody to grin at and talk to. But whom did he know, other than Marcia? And so far in this mob he had been unable to find her. He had met Marcia 4 years ago when she was Marcia Bernstein and had opened a gallery of contemporary art called the Alma, for Alma Mahler, whom she thought she resembled, down on Ponce de Leon. Opening a gallery of contemporary art in Atlanta, Georgia, was not a sound business decision, and the venture began foundering immediately. Peepgas, eager to demonstrate his clout in the world of banking to this pretty and very likable young woman, had engineered a $100,000 loan from Planner's Bank. This would have inevitably earned him shithead status, except for the fact that it was in her role as proprietress of the Alma Gallery that Marcia had met Herbert Richman and married him, after which paying back a mere $100,000 loan was no problem. Marcia was not one to forget a friend, so she had invited Peepgas to join her table at the Wilson-Lapith opening. Peepgas stood on tiptoe to see if he could spot her. "Marcia," he craned about. No Marcia. But there,